For the record, my name is Ramon Eskier, and I am counsel for the appellants in this case, Alexis Kevorkian, Odette Najarian, and AMG. The first point I wish to make is that the only claims that went to trial in this case were declaratory judgment claims. You had the appellant's claim for the seniority or priority of its deed of trust between it and the bank. The bank had also filed declaratory judgment on action with regards to the effectiveness of certain plats, the effectiveness of the assignment of the deed of trust, and whether or not the expressed consent or approval of Odette Najarian was required, who was a holder of the note and deed of trust. The first issue that the court dealt with is the issue of whether or not Mr. Kevorkian had the authority or the right to effectuate an assignment of the note and deed of trust to AMG on behalf of Odette Najarian. This was rejected in the findings of fact by the court. The court held that she had not signed it. There was no power of attorney. The court said that there was nothing otherwise authorizing Alexis Kevorkian to sign her sit. And in addition, the court rejected that the circumstances would have created an authority on behalf of Mr. Kevorkian. In this case, the court held that the evidence at trial did not establish by direct or circumstantial evidence that Alexis Kevorkian was acting for purposes of conveying Ms. Odette Najarian's interest in the subject property, or that somehow she consented to her assignment. What this then raises is, at trial and in the briefs, Your Honors, the court or the bank contended that it relied on the assignment, and that it relied upon the opinion of its title company, and it relied upon the plat that was eventually sent out for signature in electing to close the construction loan and fund this. This is probably one of the larger findings of this court, was that there was no reasonable reliance by the bank. The court held that and found that the construction loan and the distribution of proceeds occurred prior to Mr. Kevorkian's assignment of the deed of trust, 2 months before that. More importantly, a year elapsed before the title companies gave an opinion that they challenged, and they had previously, a year earlier, had already closed the loan and were funding it. But most importantly, the construction loans were distributed close to completely 2.5 years before the plat was sent out for signature. The fact that they say they relied on that is just defied. We don't know what they relied on, but from the court's findings, we know that there's three things they did not rely on, and that is the assignment, the opinion of the title company, and those plats, because they've already closed the loan and distributed the loan proceeds. Now, in making its decision, the court relied upon the case of Stagecoach versus Youngers Ranch for the proposition that a mortgagor cannot make a dedication of mortgage property without consent of the mortgagee, and that it will not be and never be presumed but must be unequivocal. In response, the lender has asserted that the really correct analysis should be as a statutory dedication under the Martini versus Smith case that's decided and the Bueller versus Sears Roebuck. This is really an important distinction, because in Martini, what we had was a road in a subdivision that a municipality then de-annexed. The question came before the court whether de-annexing that property ceased to the road that was created by that ceased to be a public road. And the court said, in applying this concept of statutory dedication, a two-pronged test, not a one-pronged test. The test wasn't a simplistic examination as to whether it was recorded. That was not the test. The test was two-pronged. First, the court was directed to look at the ordinance or the statute that governed the dedication of plats at the time the dedication was made. An important distinction in the cases is that in neither the Martini case nor the case of Buell did the litigants contest the original dedication. The court immediately went to whether it was recorded, because there was no contest as to whether it was dedicated correctly. The trial court in this case did do that examination. The judge took a look at the governing ordinance. The governing ordinance in this case was Montrose Municipal Court Section 4-7-6E, which is simple. It states that all property and easements dedicated to the city on any plat shall become the property of the city upon executing a plat, quote, free and clear of all mortgages, liens, and encumbrances.
Counsel, even if we agree with you that there was not a statutory dedication, why shouldn't we remand for the trial court to consider whether the elements of an easement by necessity, especially as to the utilities, is applicable here?
Okay. I don't think it has to be remanded on the issue of the utilities, because if you look back at the 2005 easement, an easement corridor was created by Mr. Giugiulio when the Seasons plat was first sold to Mr. Gavorgi and Ms. Odette. Nigeria, there is already a corridor there for easements. The only other easements that are in dispute are the ones that the bank, the developer rather, elected to put outside of the easement corridor that was reserved on the very first plot, not only for installation, but to come back and maintain. That's the only easement that was reserved on the Giugiulio plat.
Mr. Esker, I'm not clear about how many easements there were. Was there both a road easement and a utilities easement that were separate, or was it a single easement?
Well, if you look at it in terms of what it was for, it's a single easement. In the Giugiulio plat, there was a reservation for the installation of utilities in a corridor. Now, it's a second easement, but it's only for the maintenance, installation and maintenance of that easement. In other words, there's two easements there, but they're for the purpose of just maintaining the first easement. In other words, you have subsurface easement for utilities, and then you have the right to go in and maintain those as time goes on, or to replace or repair.
Well, but I guess part of the reason I'm confused is because the trial court said that there was access to the Seasons subdivision via an alternative road.
Correct.
And so the trial court, in making that finding, seemed to refer only to road access, not to utilities access via that alternate route.
Correct. Yeah, that is correct. What the court found is that the access onto Miami Street was adequate alternative access. It's a major thoroughfare. It accesses onto Miami Street. It does not have to do with this short Pennsylvania Street that crosses the Lot 1. There is an existing access onto a major thoroughfare. It's right there in the exhibits. It's on most of the plat maps that were shown. And the court found that as to access, that in fact, you have access onto Miami. The court correctly went after it examined the question of whether or not the application of Stagecoach was to be applied. This is not the bank, or the appellee constantly refers to its development as an island. Do not confuse, it is not landlocked. It has got a major access onto Miami. Secondly, the court rejected the arguments of pre-existing use, necessity, and estoppel, specifically with its findings that there is no pre-existing use because this property was and is still vacant. The only use was the contractor and his crew that built the road. If that is entitled to pre-existing use, then every road a contractor puts in would qualify as an easement. The court denied two of the theories of law on the fact that there was no necessity because we have this access onto Miami. And lastly, the court rejected the estoppel argument because the appellants are citizens of the state, or residents of the state of California. In May 7th of 2007, they closed on this sale, and they then even go to California and don't come back until litigation.
But was that reasonable under the estoppel concept? Now, I know that you're relying on the court's finding of no reasonable reliance, but is it really reasonable to believe that when you sell a property for commercial purposes and residential purposes, that the other side's not going to build on it and that they can't rely on easements existing?
I think it is reasonable if you would think that a developer, particularly a lender of a developer, would be communicating with and determining whether or not these easements did in fact exist, and whether or not there was any construction to be taking place. There was no communication. Nothing was offered at trial to show that either the lender or the developer made an effort to communicate with these people as to what was going on site. There was no reason for them to expect that this road was going to be put in. Miami existed. The Miami road exists. The Miami access is there. They knew that there was an easement corridor for subsurface utilities, but there was nothing there for a surface road. I would like to reserve, if you don't mind.
That's fine, Mr. Esker. You have a little over 3 minutes and 40 seconds.
I'll be on. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Perry Glantz, registration number 16869, and Nicole Strong is here with me from my firm to help with some of the exhibits from the record. May it please support counsel. What this case is about is very simple. It's very boiled down. This was exhibit 49 from the trial. And this brings, I think, into clear focus exactly what we're talking about. Mr. Esker referred to the pre-existing utility easement. That is in the middle of those green lines. That goes down the middle of those green lines. That was there when Mr. Devorgan purchased the property. What was at issue was what was added by the 2009 plat, and that's what's in green. So the 2009 plat added what's highlighted in green. I know it's difficult to see from this distance. In response to some of the court's questions with respect to the access of utilities, they all come in right here. They all go down this road and they turn here. The undisputed testimony at trial was that the City of Montrose will not issue certificates of occupancy for the 11 homes that have been built on these lots, fully constructed, hooked up to the utilities. My client is paying utilities right now, as those sit empty, because of the dispute as to the utility lines that are in or across those green lines.
Mr. Glantz, to follow up on the questions that I asked Mr. Esker, is the dispute then only concerning the utility easement as opposed to road access via Miami Street? Or is there also a road easement that is in dispute?
Correct. There is a road easement, because in the 2005 plat that was not in dispute, there's no road access easement specifically granted. In 2009, in the plat, the road for Pennsylvania Street for access was granted in that plat. Now, Mr. Esker says the bank, nobody relied on Mr. Gavorgian's assignment and signing of the plat. Well, sure they did. That's why there's utilities in those green lines. That's why there's a road on the top of Pennsylvania Street, and that's why they built all these houses. The undisputed testimony at trial was that without the Pennsylvania Street access and those utilities, you can't sell the 11 houses that are sitting there fully constructed. Further, the testimony was at trial that without the Pennsylvania Street access, this is Miami Road, this is an access. The testimony was, even if you had utilities that you could use and get a certificate of occupancy for those 11 homes, with just Miami Road, the balance of the property that the bank now owns, free and clear, becomes worthless. Because it is too far for you to develop it without two points of access. This is one that we built. This is two. The only way to develop the balance of this property that the bank owns, free and clear, that was stipulated, there's no question. Mr. Gavorgan and AMG and Associates have no interest there. It's undisputed. That can be nothing without that other access.
So, Mr. Glantz, if I understand you correctly, then what are in dispute are both the utility easement and the road easement on Pennsylvania Street.
Is that correct?
Okay.
That is correct, yes, sir. That is correct. Now, what was important was also the testimony at trial. Cameron Nevins, who was the developer that defaulted on the loans, he testified that he only dealt with Mr. Gavorgan. He met Dr. Najarian once, but she didn't have anything to do with the business. Paul Panther testified. He's a real estate developer. He talked to Mr. Gavorgan, but when Mr. Gavorgan still owned the property. He didn't know that his wife was involved in any way. That was his testimony. Bill Starnes was the surveyor who drew these plats. Said he had no idea. They relied on the title opinion. Robert Thomas was the attorney that signed the plat. He relied on the assignment and the title opinion. Patricia Maxson was the regional president of the bank. She talked to Mr. Gordon, and she had no idea that his wife had anything to do. This was the undisputed testimony. Now, what became key? Can we get 19 now, Nikki? Please. What became key was Exhibit 19. This is the document. It was undisputed. This was created by Mr. Gavorgan. It was signed by Mr. Gavorgan. This was what was relied on by everyone who testified. This is an assignment of deed of trust of all beneficial interests to AMG and Associates. Now, when the plat that's at issue was prepared, and this is the 2009 plat that's at issue, showing Pennsylvania Street. This is what's now highlighted in green down below. When this was all prepared, the title company looked at Exhibit 19 and said, AMG and Associates, Alexis Gavorgan, managing member, holds a deed of trust based upon that assignment. Now, Mr. Gavorgan testified that even though he and his wife owned the AMG and Associates together, he runs it. He doesn't go to her to make those decisions. And what's interesting, when asked at trial about Exhibit 19, and when Mr. Eskewer asked Mr. Gavorgan about Exhibit 19, he said, is that your signature? Answer, correct, that is my signature. Question, did Odette Najarian participate in this signature? Answer, she did not. Question, was there a reason? Answer, no. Question, there was no reason for her to participate. What Mr. Gavorgan didn't say at trial was that this wasn't intended to assign all beneficial interests like it said. He didn't testify to that. Dr. Najarian testified at trial, went under cross-examination by me, that until her deposition in this litigation, she'd never seen that. Now, what's important from a legal perspective in that regard is that Mr. Gavorgan testified, he signed this, I believe the exact quote is two or three times. They sent him the plat, he signed it, he sent it back. They sent him the plat, he signed it, he sent it back. They sent him the plat, perhaps a third time, he signed it and sent it back. Every one of those times it appeared as it does here, with his signature, line, and AMG and Associates. Every one of the people in that right-hand column signed after that. The mayor of Montrose, the city clerk, the city attorney. This is the attorney's certification.
So, Mr. Glantz, notwithstanding all of those signatures and all of this apparent reliance, wasn't it apparent that the original deed of trust was in the names of both Mr. Gavorgan and Ms. Najarian?
Yes, but then it was concluded by everyone who looked at it at the time, from the title company to the surveyor to the attorney, that this transferred all beneficial interest, because just like today, the only person that anybody ever saw was Mr. Gavorian. And that was who everybody relied on. In fact, what's most important to the law of apparent authority, and this is what I think the judge got off track. He was looking for, where's the power of attorney? Where is Odette Najarian's transfer of authority to Mr. Gavorian? That's not the law of apparent authority. Apparent agency is created by evidence of written or spoken words or other conduct of the principal, which reasonably interpreted causes a person to believe that the principal consents to have the act done on his or her behalf by a person purporting to act for him. So the focus is on us, the bank, the city, the surveyor, the attorney who signed that. The focus of apparent authority is, were we reasonable in believing that Mr. Gavorian had the authority to sign this assignment, which clearly says all beneficial interest in the deed of trust.
But what did Dr. Najarian do to give that appearance of authority? I mean, well, I can see where you're arguing that the husband, you know, carried on as if he's representing the entity. But what did she do?
And I think there's a key case, and this is a case I actually handed to the judge in my opening argument at the trial. It's Broomhall versus Edgemont Mining Corporation. It's 340 Pacific 2nd, 869. And that's a case where the Colorado Supreme Court, still the law of this state, found that the inaction of the wife made it reasonable for those dealing with them to conclude that the husband had apparent authority. Very quickly, in a nutshell, in that case, mineral rights were assigned to the husband. The husband immediately assigned them to his wife. He then turned around, made another deal, and assigned them to Edgemont Mining Corporation. Sometime later, the wife said, hey, those are mine. Well, the Colorado Supreme Court said, no, I'm sorry, they're not. Everybody involved in this situation relied on your husband. You were not involved. You didn't have anything to do with it. So that, they found, the Supreme Court ruled that the agency of one spouse to act for the other may be established by the circumstances without proof of an express authorization. And again, when you look at the actual law, which is, were we reasonable in relying on the situation of only Mr. Gavorian ever being involved with anybody? Mr. Panther testified, this was an AMG and Associates project, which is his company. His wife is a dentist. You know, she's a practicing dentist.
Counsel, I understand your apparent authority argument. I want to redirect you to the easement by estoppel,
yes,
I asked about earlier. The trial court in this case found plaintiffs are stopped from denying an easement by estoppel. Plaintiffs were residents of California and they did not travel to Montrose, Colorado at any time during construction. Those working on the subdivision had no communications with the plaintiffs during construction other than the submission of proposed plats for signature. There was no showing that the plaintiffs knew that street improvements were being constructed.
Here it is, three times. He testified. He got this. He saw it. He signed it. Pennsylvania Street. He's a developer. He's a real estate developer. I mean, he sat silently by signing this three times. If they believed that this plat wasn't appropriate, this is specifically designed for the installation of utilities of all kinds, the installation of Pennsylvania Street. So he ruled, well, they live in California. Well, here it is, three times. He was said exactly what was going to happen and what did happen. One point I would like to make quickly, if I could, before my time is up. This is there. This is Exhibit 25. Pennsylvania Street's right over here. This has all been built. And these sit empty because of this. Now, to talk about the easements, the problem in the court's order, if you look at his ruling on easement by prior use, he applied the wrong test. There's no case cited, so I'm not sure exactly what Judge Shum was looking at. But he applied a four-part test, one of which was the elements of necessity. And then he found that we hadn't proven necessity because of Miami Road. But that's not the test. The test is in Lobato v. Taylor, 71 P3rd 938. And those elements, and there are five. The Servian and Dominant Estates were once under common ownership. They still are. Until there's action on the foreclosure, the bank still owns the entire property. The rights alleged were exercised prior to the severance of the estate. There they are. Streets, utilities, houses, $4 million of infrastructure and construction. It's there. The use was not merely temporary. Stipulated at trial, these are not temporary improvements. These are permanent. The continuation of this use is reasonably necessary to the enjoyment of the parcel. Again, undisputed testimony at trial. We cannot develop this parcel. We cannot sell these houses without this dedication. So it is absolutely necessary for us to use this. Otherwise, it sits empty as it is today. And finally, the final element, not necessity, but a contrary intention is neither expressed nor implied. The testimony at trial was that the Gordons never had any claim to this area that the bank had a first position. The bank owns that property free and clear. The Gordon and Dr. Najarian have no right to it. We can't use any of it right now because of this ruling, because the city of Montrose will not issue certificates of occupancy as long as these green lines exist in dispute. That's prior use. An investment of $4 million, homes, streets, gas lines, everything. It was there, it's there today. The only reason we can't use it is because of this issue about the signature on the 09 plat. The only person that could have avoided this situation is Mr. Gordon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gons.
I only wish to make just a couple more comments and close. First of all, when the excerpt was read as to Mr. Gorgon saying that her signature was not required, you must remember what he's talking about is that they sent three plats out that only required the signature of AMG. They never prepared a plat that asked Ms. Odette Najarian to sign the plat. To him, to Mr. Gavorkian, he gets a plat that says AMG is to sign the consent. AMG signs it each time. He's not told that Odette is to also sign it. They just provide for AMG's signature. The last thing I quickly is the fact that the failure of the trial court to abide the statutory procedure of 1351.112 with regards to further relief is that the statute states that there's a procedure. The court is going to step outside of the declaratory relief that's prayed for. And it has a very distinct procedure in the statute, which is incorporated into Rules 57H. And that is one of the parties has to make a petition to the court for the what is essentially coercive relief. The petition has to be made. The court has to pass on the sufficiency of the petition. The court then has to note for show cause, give notice to anybody affected, and have a show cause hearing as to that additional relief that the court is considering or based on a petition. In this case, the court took it upon itself to not apply Rule 57H at all. And I think that that has to be looked at by this court because of the fact that the relief as to the requirement of $17,500 being paid was essentially a relief that was not allowed under Rule 57H without going through the procedure first defined in the statute and then defined in the rule. If every court said my equitable powers allow me to circumvent Rule 57H, you can render this new rule meaningless. Thank you for hearing me.
Counsel, if we agree with you that the trial court shouldn't have gone that additional step, what kind of remand instructions should we send back?
Well, I think what you've got to do is have the court consider what you've discussed here. The utility issues on remand, the ones that are resolved, and there are the unresolved issues as to the utilities outside the corridor, the ones that are disadvantaged. That's my thoughts.
Thank you.
I have nothing further. Thank you for hearing us today.
Thank you, Mr. Escure. Thank you again, Mr. Glantz. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. They were very helpful. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.